Hello and welcome to the ARO Global Group third quarter 2022 results call with Zach Lubin, CEO, CIO, and Phil Shepard, CCO. My name is Sergey and I will be your coordinator for today's event. Please note this call is being recorded and for the duration of the call, your lines will be in a listen-only mode. However, you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of the call. This can be done by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad to register your question. If you require assistance at any time, please press star 0 and you will be connected to an operator. I will now hand you over to your host, Zach Lubin, the CEO and CIO of ARO Global Group, to begin today's conference. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergey. As you see from the results that we announced, the core cash performance of the business continues to be very strong. We were pleased with the outturn for the quarter and are pleased with the current trading as well. We delivered $276 million of cash collections in year to date, which is up on prior period. We're performing considerably above ERC and continue to see that trend, which we're really pleased about. I mean, ultimately, this is a cash business and driving cash collections is at the core of our financial performance, and we're pleased that that's going well. That's translated into a strong EBITDA outturn. And again, we're pleased with the progress we're making in running the business tightly to ensure the conversion of collections to cash. That has led to the gradual deleveraging that you've seen. And as you know, as we move into ACO2 and we co-invest at the 10% level alongside the fund, we think that by deploying more capital with less of the ARO balance sheet included, whilst collecting the back book at 100 cents in the pound effectively, or the euro, it drives us to a natural deleveraging process, which we think events have accelerated, as you see in the next two sections, both with ACO2 performing well in terms of fundraising and deployment, and in terms of the sale we announced this morning. In terms of ACO2, we continue to close investors at a comfortable level. So we've closed $1.4 billion now, two further closings since our Q2 results were announced in August. We continue to be very pleased with the pipeline, and we see the progress of people doing their work, site visits, investment committee approvals, et cetera, and we've got an incredible investor base. It has done extremely well in terms of who we're attracting to the strategy. Obviously, this credit opportunistic strategy in Europe is incredibly both well-timed and well-placed given the macro, and that's translated into very strong fundraising momentum. We'd expect to make material progress towards our goal by year end and to complete the fundraise of ACO2 early in 23. ACO1's continued to perform really well, has performed ahead of forecast through the process, including the most recent quarters. And is trending well in the current quarter. Deal IRR is 19.1. That's on an unlevered basis, as you know, and is after all of our servicing costs. That's higher than our historical track record, and the fund has performed at about 148% of forecast and continues to perform strongly, including us having made our first distribution back to LPs, so starting ACO1's process of returning capital to investors. Origination volumes are up. We've invested about 11% more this year on a like-for-like basis to last year. We see a strong fourth quarter as the market continues to widen, and the quality of underlying collaterals we're getting for those higher IRRs is in line with what you'd expect given the macro and it being a buyer's market in this context. We'll remind you that as we talked about when we issued these bonds post the TDR acquisition, that this progression, which was also the PLC strategy of getting to capital light by moving to the 10% co-invest in ACO2, which we're now obviously fundraising successfully against, that has a natural deleveraging effect. By the time you get the investment returns at these good levels overlaid with the profitability of the servicing fees, you get to a very, and obviously the management fees and the carry, you get a very strong return on equity, and we'd expect that to continue to deliver well as we scale the origination in ACO2. Obviously, the most significant news we announced today was the divestment of CapQuest and Mars. As you see, we've also sold 50% of our wholly owned UK unsecured book, so assets where we have co-investors we've retained, but assets that were a wholly owned part of our UK unsecured back book is what we sold half of to Intrum alongside CapQuest and Mars. The deal was agreed with a March 2022 lockbox at 105% of the book value of that March date. And as Phil will walk you through the reconciliation to the closing timeline and the final cash proceeds, but we're pleased with the price. We're pleased with the focus that that allows us to achieve strategically. To explain the strategic context, the UK over the years has built up a considerable capacity of unsecured consumer servicing and collections businesses. You'll know many of them through the bond market, but obviously Intrum is now here in large size, alongside Cabot, Lau, PRA, LCM, and others. That feels to us, and from our experience, like quite a crowded, very well-supplied sector for UK unsecured, which at the end of the day, particularly when you look at a European strategic context, unsecured parts of balance sheets, you know, for banks tend to be more around 5% of their balance sheet. The critical mass of a bank's balance sheet tends to be in where we've focused most of our platforms in the different mortgage segments, small business loan segments, mixed-use real estate, and other heavier asset classes. And therefore, from our perspective, there was a strategic rationale to focus our platforms at where basically demand is biggest because there's a lot of lending in those secured categories and where supply is less, as opposed to focus our platforms where the available stock of assets is the smaller part of the bank's balance sheet, but supply was considerable across the sector. And so we think this is a constructive consolidation for the sector, but we think in terms of our focus, it is the right strategic outcome for us. If I put that in the context of some numbers, of the last $1.8 billion we've invested in ACO 1, taking it to the current day, about $9 million of that has been in UK unsecured, i.e. less than 0.5% effectively has been in UK unsecured. So this is not an asset class where we've found the risk-adjusted returns of those positions are attractive to us from a fund perspective, versus the benefits of having hard asset collateral security when you buy mortgages and equivalent, and given the opportunities for returns in other markets. And so it really has not been a relevant part of our fund origination, so we'll have no origination consequences for us, and we continue to keep the rest of our strong UK platforms, including Dryden's, and so it doesn't affect our geographic footprint at all. And so from that perspective, we think this is a very constructive step to our strategic mission, which is to be a very good vertically integrated fund manager where the platforms we do own feed our funds. This is a completely consistent step with that. And obviously, you know, by realizing the cash here, we de-risk the back book and accelerate our transition to having a business that is less capital intensive going forward. If I move forward to the next section, you also see that the core platform segment has gone very well, EBITDA up by more than 50%. And you also see that we've moved forward and continue to see as our NAV grows and the management fees and servicing fees from that NAV contribute to platform EBITDA, the transition to capital light, which is obviously the future of our earnings streams, or at least the majority of them, is progressing nicely in accordance with our plans. And we've done a nice job in terms of widening all the additional elements of our activities, whether that's on the ESG side, whether that's on getting an ever wider and deeper set of investors. And we've had great third-party wins, particularly in Ireland, but across other parts of the business on the pure third-party servicing side. So this was just a very pleasing quarter for all of those things. I think you'll see our pivot towards delivering the strategy of being a vertically integrated fund manager on a delevered basis is progressing nicely. And we expect that progress now to accelerate. A lot of the issues we've cleared out over the last 12 months, you know, the cost savings we did at the beginning of the 12-month period, redoing the bond structure at the beginning of the post-TDR purchase, raising ACO2, and now divesting of CapQuest and Mars, which were not feeding the funds, and thereby moving the business forward, is all great strategic progress and sets us up, I think, with the strong ACO2 and the strong investing environment and the rapid now collections and distributions of funds to ACO1 investors to really be delivering our strategic mission in a way that we're really, really pleased with the business. If we move to page 4, the cash generation has been good on ACO1. And so we've hit a point where we have done that first distribution. We're collecting, as I said, almost 50% above underwrite. Deployment in the third quarter remained stronger over the year-ago period. Year-ago period, that was about 116. We're about 198 in Q3, split between ACO1 up to the 5th of August, when the first close of ACO2 happened. And almost all of it went to ACO2 after that. And we continue to see the fundraising momentum as we look to the investor base. We've made nice progress in North America and nice progress in the Middle East alongside our core European franchise. And again, feel comfortable that investors are entirely supportive of our fundraising strategy in the sense that when you look at how we invest compared to all prior periods in which we've raised capital, selling the reality of the situation on the ground that Europe has, you know, cost of living crisis, interest rate issues, war issues, possible recession, et cetera, it makes people comfortable that a fund that has now only invested 2-3% of ACO2 and so has, you know, 97-98% dry powder into a 20-year experience track record with our big platform footprint, is the right place to be to basically hedge the rest of their portfolios and have exposure to whatever adverse events happen in Europe, which in the past has led to us having higher returns in our investment program. And so selling that story has frankly been relatively easy, and we've had great investor momentum, and we expect to complete the fundraisers we discussed in early 2023. If I move to page 5, bit more detail on the sale we announced today. So we divested half of the portfolio where we were the sole owner, so none of our historical private equity JVs and not our fund investments, but just where is our wholly owned portion of the back book, and it's just the UK unsecured portion. That price, as you saw, is $157.8 million as of the lockbox date, which was March of 22. There's then been cash collections to the benefit of Interim subsequent to that. We obviously need to get regulatory approval, given CapQuest and Mars have regulatory permissions. And so this deal will close next year, so we'll give you more details on that. We think in terms of the strategic rationale, as I mentioned earlier, it's not been a major part. In fact, it's been a negligible part of our recent origination, and therefore we don't think it is strategically a good fit for us, particularly in a sector that is very, very well supplied and represents a relatively small part of banks' balance sheets. We also think that when you look at the different regulatory demands in this sector, I think you either need to be consolidator, you need to be consolidated. But I think the idea of having 6 or 7 significant companies in this space trying to meet the digitization journey and the customer journey and the regulatory demand journey was not the right place. And I think it had a considerable drag on returns from that level of supply. And so I think it's sector positive to see what is probably still a consolidation requirement to get to the right supply-demand balance, obviously subject to what happens in the macro. But we felt that when we look at our strategy, which is really to own platforms that have good fit into feeding our funds, CapQuest and Mars didn't meet that criteria, and so divesting them was the right strategic outcome for us. So with that, I will hand over to Phil to walk through the outcomes of the quarter.
Thanks, Zach, and good morning, everyone. Before I go through the underlying results, let me first walk through the financial impacts of the divestments, which are shown on slide 7. The accounting is relatively complex, but I'll try and simplify it down into the key elements. So starting with what we're actually selling and the commercial appraisal of the divestment. At September 2022, the UK wholly owned unsecured backbook had a carrying value of £265 million and was equivalent to 27% of our 84-month ERC. And we've agreed the sale of 50% of the book, i.e. circa 14% of our ERC, which will be achieved through a 50-50 profit share arrangement in the portfolios. In addition to the divestment of the portfolios, we've agreed the 100% sale of the non-core platforms, CapQuest and Mars UK. And these platforms will continue to service the portfolios going forward. The transaction is subject to a lockbox mechanism on the portfolios commencing end of March 2022 and subject to completion accounts on the platforms, where I expect to transfer around £10 million of net assets on completion. So economically, the proceeds of £157.8 million as at March 2022 represents 105% of the carrying value of 50% of the portfolios and the net assets of the platforms at that date. In addition, I do not expect any material change in leverage or platform profitability as a result of the transaction. So now turning to the accounting treatment and understanding the bridge between the 105% effective economics of the deal against the reported accounting treatment. For accounting purposes, 100% of the assets and liabilities subject to the divestment, which for this purpose include 100% of the portfolios, have been reclassified to assets or liabilities held for sale. And this reclassification results in a £26 million loss within adjusting items. The loss comprises £14 million, representing the difference between the carrying value and the sale proceeds on the portfolios and platforms, and £6 million in relation to write-off of assets, primarily relating to intangible assets arising on the acquisition by TDR, and £6 million of transaction costs, with the main components being legal costs. The economic deal of 105% would imply a gain of around £7 million. The gain is reduced to the reporting accounting loss of £20 million before the £6 million transaction costs due to two factors of a similar quantum each. Firstly, we are derecognising the full 100% of the portfolios rather than merely the 50% being economically sold. And secondly, we've reported income from March to September on 100% of the portfolios, and this is reversed given the lockbox mechanism. I believe that the divestment achieves an important strategic milestone, accelerating our transition to the leading integrated fund manager, whilst also representing economically a very attractive deal for the group and de-risking the balance sheet at a time when the economic backdrop is relatively uncertain. Moving on to slide 8, and for those that have followed the group for some time, you'll notice that we are publishing our segmental reporting for Q3 for the first time. It is our intention to continue to publish our segmental performance at each quarterly reporting date rather than merely at the half and full year. As reported in previous quarters, the group has continued to deliver a strong cash performance, with adjusted EBITDA up 19% to 217.5 million, driven by the ongoing strong collections performance, and I'll talk in more detail about collections performance in due course. But this has enabled us to continue to reduce leverage to 4.4 times, down from 4.8 times as at December, and down from 4.5 times as at June. EBITDA was 73.2 million for the period, some 11.2 million lower than the corresponding period last year. Consistent with the position reported at the half-year results, this was entirely due to the non-cash impairment write-ups to our investment portfolios taken in 2021, which were 18 million higher than compared with 2022. Stripping this non-cash item out of the results, EBITDA improved by circa 7 million, reflecting the growth in our capital-light revenues. The proportion of the total group EBITDA derived from the platform segment, which represents our capital-light businesses, grew from 19% to 34% year on year. The loss before tax and adjusting items was 1.1 million and was impacted by the higher interest costs and by the non-cash foreign exchange retranslation on our net euro liability position. And I'll explain these matters in more detail in one of the upcoming slides. So moving on to the segmental results and starting with the platform segment on slide 9. And just to recap, the platform segment represents the capital-light revenues of the group from our integrated asset management and servicing and fund management activities. Revenues have grown by 19% year-on-year to 153.8 million. The growth arises from the strong appetite for our services from our customers with continued servicing contract wins. The build of our proposition with bolt-on acquisition in the hospitality asset management sector in Portugal, and the growing funds under management driving increasing management fees. As a result of the growth in revenue, we've increased EBITDA by 51% to 24.6 million, with Q3 EBITDA of 9.9 million compared with 3.6 million in Q3 2021. The EBITDA margin has expanded by 340 basis points from 12.6% to 16%. Going forward, I expect the EBITDA margin to continue to widen as management fees and income growth outpace the cost growth. And EBITDA will continue to grow as we accelerate our transition to become the leading integrated fund manager. Moving on to the balance sheet segment on slide 10. The cash performance has been strong with collections 108% of ERC and 7% higher than prior year. Despite the strong cash performance, EBITDA decreased by 22 million to 66.3 million. As I noted earlier, the year-on-year variance is predominantly due to the non-cash impairment write-ups, which were 18 million higher in 2021 compared with 2022. Despite the uncertain economic backdrop, I'm delighted that we've continued to deliver a strong collections performance, and this is shown in detail on slide 11 and emphasises the strong focus we have on cash. Q3 collections were 10% higher year on year, and for the 9 months totaled 275.6 million, representing 108% of ERC for the 9 month period and 104% for Q3. The resilience of our collections performance across all types of portfolios and all geographies is encouraging. And despite the cost of living impacts and broader economic uncertainty, I believe our ERC reflects assumptions in line with the uncertain outlook and broader economic expectations. And we continue to adopt a cautious approach to our ERC and underwriting of new portfolio acquisitions. The strong collections have driven adjusted EBITDA to 218 million for the period, up 19% on the prior year. Slide 12 shows the group segments, which primarily relates to the centrally controlled overhead costs. Consistent with the position as reported at the half year, the segmental loss has improved by 2.3 million to 17.7 million, and there are a number of factors driving this reduction. As our funds under management grows, there is an increased allocation of our group overheads to the fund through designated charges. As the back book continues to decrease and our funds continue to grow, this trend will continue. As previously announced, we've fully delivered the targeted cost savings of 20 million and are maintaining a strong focus on cost control. And lastly, we've reinvested part of these savings into the development of our business in areas such as fundraising. And this investment allows us to scale our operations and accelerate the transition to our integrated fund manager model. And we are seeing the impacts of this investment with the success of securing additional commitments into ACO2, the growth in origination by 11%, and the growth in the platform's EBITDA by 51%. The full underlying income statement is shown on slide 13, and I'll focus on the foreign exchange movement and interest costs. As we complete the transition to the integrated fund manager, the group generates surplus income in euros. This is predominantly due to the growth in management fees and, in due course, carried interest in our funds. And as such, the group is maintaining a net euro liability position. The retranslation of this liability position gives rise to some non-cash P&L volatility, which was a 8.1 million cost in the period to September 2022. In addition, the interest costs have risen by 14.3 million compared with a similar period last year, due to the refinancing following the take private transaction, the costs of the high level of liquidity headroom that we're running with, and more latterly, rising interest rates. Slide 14 shows the free cash flow generation, which rose by 34% to 160 million compared with Q3 2021. Consistent with prior periods, we are now seeing free cash flow exceed the cash investments on portfolios of 137 million. This surplus of 23 million between our free cash flow and our portfolio investments is expected to increase as we start investing more at a 10% co-investment into ACO2 rather than the 25% co-investment into ACO1. The net debt position is shown on slide 15 and further highlights the strong surplus cash flow generation over portfolio investments as we transition to our integrated fund manager model. Overall, net debt did increase during the period despite the strong trading performance, partly as a result of the foreign exchange impact of retranslating our euro borrowings, which increased the reported sterling equivalent debt by circa 40 million, together with the working capital outflow that predominantly arose during Q1 this year, in part due to the growth of our servicing activity. Net debt will obviously reduce upon completion of the divestments, but I also expect the underlying trading to drive lower net debt, particularly as investments into ACO2 have a 10% co-investment level. Slide 16 shows our leverage and funding position. The strong collections in the period have led to a reduction in leverage to 4.4 times from 4.8 times as at December 2021, and 4.5 times at June 2022. As you know, deleveraging remains a core focus, and we remain committed to reducing leverage to circa 3 times and repaying debt over the medium term. We have a strong funding base with no bond maturities until 2026. The weighted average term on our debt is 4.4 years, and we have 237 million of liquidity headroom. Given the current economic challenges and the impacts that this is having on the high yield funding markets, I believe the strength of our liquidity and funding position and our capital-light model leaves us well-placed to take advantage of the opportunities in our markets. We've made excellent progress accelerating the transition to the leading integrated fund manager, which enables us to scale operations, grow our capital-light revenue streams without placing strain on our balance sheet. The strong cash performance, the progress in raising ACO2, and the divestment of our non-core platforms with the associated sale of 50% of the wholly owned UK unsecured portfolios show the strong progress that we were making on this transition. Thank you, and I'll now hand back to Zach.
Thank you, Phil. I guess as a strategic wrap-up, moving to slide 18, what I would say is that where we're going with this business is very simple, which is that, as we've talked about on many prior calls, that if we raise capital, deploy it well, earn high investment returns, and then overlay that with management fees, carry, and servicing fees from servicing platforms that also win third-party business and have good margins, this business has a very high return on equity and becomes a very attractive asset. I think we've made good progress on literally every single one of those dimensions. By continuing to collect the back book well, we also amortize our debt capital. And by the sale we announced today, we focus the profitability, as Phil describes, as well as the strategic vertical integration. Our platforms will feed our funds. And obviously, we accelerate the deleveraging of taking the bonds down by making the back book wear off in that form. I think doing that while having good enough investment performance so ERC actually grew during the period is also constructive. And so just on each of the metrics that are there, our strategy is working. And as ACO2 starts deploying in scale and Arrow is only 10% of that, you would expect that story to accelerate considerably as everything we collect on the back book is 100 cents in the dollar for full back book, plus what we get on effectively ACO1, where we're getting, you know, obviously close to 25%, plus the servicing fees, management fees, and carry will, in that form, given the performance of ACO1, also come through our cash flow statement in due course. And so the strategy is working, and I think as you look at it, today is a positive day of accelerating that by selling the non-core part of the back book and the platforms that weren't feeding the funds. We've made considerable strategic progress, and I think with ACO2 closing its size early next year, what you'll see in 2023 is a very rapid progress towards effectively the deleveraging and the benefits of this strategy. I think all of that's being done in a economic and social context of macro uncertainty, and so we're looking after customers, looking after our employees, and making sure we run the business in the right social and community way, which we feel good we're doing. And the fact that we've been able to do that and our Python scores are up, which is our staff satisfaction, you know, we're driving a positive business internally and externally whilst achieving the strategic progression and the deleveraging. And so with that, we're quite happy with the performance and look forward to questions. Operator, if you want to open it up to questions, please.
Certainly. As a reminder, to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1. The first question comes from Lars Duser from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes, very well, yes. Lars.
Perfect. Hello, good morning, all. I have a few. First of all, on cash EBITDA, so year to date, we stand at 218 million across the group. And I just wanted to get a sense again for the Q4 seasonality. I know, you know, for other businesses in that sector, Q4 tends to be a larger quarter, but then clearly in your case, you have more secured exposure, which could be more lumpy. We also have a macro environment, which is probably not the same as it used to be. So just trying to, you know, get a bit of a color how I should think about Q4 EBITDA, cash EBITDA.
I think if I give you the strategic version of that, and then Phil gives you some numerical guidance, I think the strategic side of that is So far, Q4 has traded well. We're pleased with cash collections up to this date. Obviously, we've seen a significant chunk of the quarter already. We also made the first distribution to the fund. That was on the backs of a very large collection of materials, the largest collection in our history, in the beginning of October, which obviously falls in this quarter. So we have reasons that collections should perform well in this quarter, certainly as of where we stand now. And then I guess when you talk about cyclicality, I would just remind, obviously, with ACO2 now fully live and all new investments and new name exposures going to ACO2 from the 5th of August 2022 onwards, what that means is even if we have a big origination quarter, which historically we and the sector have had in the fourth quarter, Arrow will only be investing, you know, 10% of that, right? So in practice, you should start to see the jaws of deleveraging expand as we collect well, taking that to reduction of debt and collection to balance sheet, whilst as we invest well, and we do expect to have a strong investment quarter, only 10% of that is coming from balance sheet and 90% from third-party capital. And so, I mean, Phil can coach on the specific guidance he wants to give, but we'd expect it to, as a matter of business model and current performance execution, you know, progress in a positive direction.
Yeah, so shall I add to that? I mean, I think as we've consistently said, I think looking at this business quarter on quarter, you do get some lumpiness. I think the important thing is that we will continue to show a reduction in leverage. We've consistently seen that over the course of this year. And I would expect that trend to continue. So I guess in terms of the guidance of around leverage, which is typically what we give, you know, we've guided to that leverage will be around 4x by the year end, and I would expect it to be you know, around that level. It may be just slightly higher. You know, you'll have seen that the retranslation of the euro debt has added about 40 million to our net debt level, which impacts leverage by sort of 0.1, 0.2 times. So we may be just slightly north of that, but I think the important thing is to focus on the trajectory of leverage through time, which we continue to expect to decrease, and getting to our target over the medium term of 3x, which I think is the more important story, because, you know, our business model naturally allows us to delever, and as we go forward investing at 10%. With the high returns that we're generating, then you'll see that leverage accelerate into future periods.
Very, very helpful. I guess the other question then would be, if I see the purchases here today, the own balance sheet purchases, you are already at 137 million. I had assumed, you know, when you roadshowed for the deal, that this year will end up around 140 million, which seems now probably a bit on the low side. So just try to get a feeling whether Q4 purchases will also come down hard here, or whether we have to assume a similar run rate and hence the full year will be, you know, maybe a bit higher than the 150 million or so, which I think was the upper end you guided to.
Yeah, I would expect purchases to be around the 150 for the full year. It largely depends just upon the completions that run through into Q4, but certainly, you know, and the trajectory into next year when we're co-investing at the 10% level will be a function of the origination volumes, yeah, scaling that we can make into that area.
Yeah, I'll add just a little bit of color to that, which is you'll appreciate that the way the process works is we committed to the fund in the first close. As subsequent closings of the fund occur, that has the natural effect of bringing our share of the fund down, and hence the investors who join the fund more laterally, who haven't funded anything yet, obviously need to rebalance to fund that which has been done, given the fund started investing from the 5th of August. And so as we get these completions, it allows us to purchase a large amount in Q4, but for Arrow's required contribution to that to be on a net basis quite low to get to the 10% that we've committed to. And so just the way the mechanics work out, I understand why you see the numbers as you do. I think I would just ask you to judge it when you see it at Q4. By then, you'll see the fund largely at its target size, and the consequence of that will be the rebalancing has occurred, so that you'll see the Q4 purchases, you'll see what cash we had to put into those versus other new investors who haven't put in anything yet. And when you see that rebalancing occur, it will all make sense in terms of getting to the target origination levels we want whilst Arrow invests at that 10% level, and then you get the blended average number, which is why Phil's confident that the 150 is still a reasonable guidance.
That's reassuring. Okay. Two more from my side, and I hope they're quick. I mean, one is a bit boring, but on the working capital side, it was now year-to-date a $54 million outflow, I think. Some of it driven, I think, by, one-offs, but something else clearly also due to growth of the business. And I just want to understand, is any of that coming back, maybe already, in Q4? Or how shall we think about working capital here down the line?
Yeah, so the one-off that's happened in the quarter, is the acquisition of Details, which has added around about $10 million to the working capital movement. So I think at Q1 we were at $34 million, and we're at $54 million for the Q3. And so that delta of the $20 million is $10 million is due to the acquisition of Details, and then clearly the growth in the business it does lead to where you're having servicing, the expansion of your servicing and the income that you're generating does lead to the increase in working capital. I don't expect working capital to the working capital outflow in future periods to be anything like it has been this year. It has been a couple of one-offs.
Right. And then last but not least, quickly talking about the UK deal. I mean, first of all, it would be interesting to know how you think about use of proceeds. It looks like, you want to deliver, and you have a bit of optionality as well in terms of debt repayment, looking at the FRN. But just your thoughts on that, really, how you want to invest that cash, how you want to use it. And then on the valuation front, I mean, I appreciate, you sold this at 105% of book value as per March. But then if I look at it on an ERC basis, it seems like, you have sold this at 47% of 120-month ERC. Now, I think it's not the end of the world, but, clearly from a secondary valuation perspective, it looks like this has come in materially below where we have seen prior valuations, which have been, around 70 to 80% EV, 120-month ERC, and some of the players, in the past obviously paid much more than that. So just to get a feeling for why this marker has come down, I guess, and whether it has to do with where we are in the market at the moment, whether it has to do with the UK in particular, just understanding a bit, how you got to that valuation and why you deemed it to be attractive now.
So do you want to take the use of capital question, and then I'll take the second one?
Yeah. Okay. So, clearly in terms of the use of capital, we will take a decision when we actually get the proceeds. Clearly, the completion isn't going to be till Q2 next year when we've got regulatory approval. So we'll take the decision then. I will add that, you know, clearly we value capital highly, and we'll take you know appropriate decision about whether we reduce debt, whether we utilize some of that capital to expand the integrated fund management proposition through bolt-on acquisition or invest in the funds. But you can see that we have an ongoing trajectory to reduce debt, to reduce leverage, and I think we'll not only with the proceeds of this divestment, but also on an underlying basis, we'll continue to see cash inflows into the group, particularly when we're investing at 10%. So, you're correct. We've got optionality, and we'll take the decision in due course when the proceeds come in.
Phil, if I might just jump in there. I mean, would you rule out a dividend? I mean, I get it's also, the sponsor's decision here. You don't have any capacity under the ratio test, but there's clearly, general baskets and stuff. So a dividend seems to be ruled out. Is that a fair take?
I mean, as you clearly have, heard from us many times, and you heard from TDR at the point of the refinancing, The profit maximizing strategy for TDR is to create an integrated fund manager, and an integrated fund manager has lower levels of leverage than we have, and so clearly it's slightly the shareholders' decision. But I'd be very, very surprised if they took the view of a dividend. So, their profit maximising strategy is to delever, reduce debt, not take a dividend.
And Mars, I'll take your final question. But I mean, just to re-emphasize what Phil just said, we just want to be crystal clear. Our priority is to deleverage. I mean, particularly until we get to our target guidance. And so I think you can take assurance from that. On your last question on valuation of what we sold, I just walk you through what it is and hence how to think about it, right? Which is, since late in 2019, we've been investing alongside the funds. Prior to that, we did about $5.5 billion of total asset value. Arrow's portion of it was small, but we did a lot of co-investments alongside private equity, as you'll know from the company's history. And so those more recent vintages, the stuff done in ACL1, the stuff done in private equity co-investments, which make up the super majority, I mean, almost 100% of everything we've done for the last 4 years, those are not what's being sold here, right? Because those are being kept. We're only selling our wholly owned back book. So if you think about the wholly owned back book, these are UK unsecured portfolios that we bought, call it 3 years ago or older. And as you'd expect, the cost to collect those is quite a bit higher. UK unsecured has very high cost to collect relative to secured assets. And so the math you're doing is right from a technical perspective, but I think misses quite a lot of context in the extrapolation, in that obviously assets that are, more than 3 or 4 years old have a legacy cost to collect, which is higher because the portfolios are considerably older. And obviously you've got the macro overlay. So when you play it through and your comparison, which was gross ERC before servicing cost versus purchase price, I would just tell you, obviously, the other variable that's critical is cost to collect, and the assets that we're selling are literally the highest cost to collect assets that are in the group. And so I think when you look at the implied net IRR, while we're not going to disclose that here, you can be comfortable that when we analyzed the net IRR that we were selling at, we felt it was a very good capital allocation decision to take cash back and invest it in the core strategy or invest it in deleveraging. And so that's why you can't just run the straight extrapolation. If you talk about the sector, unsecured has higher cost to serve than secured, and stuff that's 4 years old and older, all the way back to 2005, has stuff that's higher cost to collect than current stuff. Those two factor into your equation to build a gross to net bridge on collections, then do the same IRR calc or value calc you've just done. And I think you'll see it was a very good capital allocation decision by management to take this transaction.
I see. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, and it's great that you share that color on the call. It's obviously not something, you know, which is in the disclosure of the documents you gave out this morning. So I appreciate the additional color there. Thank you, Zach.
Yeah, Lars. Thanks. Appreciate that.
Carl Strecker from Guggenheim. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks very much. just in terms of the expected evolution on ACO 2, so I guess as I think about it, I think you disclosed the first close at 1.1 at the end of the second quarter, 1.5 at the end of the, last quarters, and then I guess 1.5 at the end of the third quarter, yeah. And the expectation is that you get to 2.5 billion by early 2023. Is that effectively kind of a linear increase in, you know, further commitments, or is there any acceleration expected in terms of the timeline to getting to the 2.5 billion total size?
Yeah. So the first close was 1.1 billion on the 5th of August of 2022. The second close and third close happened in this quarter, which took us to 1.4. So we've made nice progressive progress. I don't think you can do a linear extrapolation. I mean, the investor base that we have is heavily concentrated around sovereign wealth, pension, and insurance. And you'll remember in ACL 1, the average ticket size was 85 million. So these are large tickets. This isn't picking up $5 and $10 million checks from high net worth. This is getting large sovereign wealth funds, pension funds, insurance companies, U.S. state plans to commit to the fund. As you know, that process is not quick. You don't get that kind of scale of capital in, you know, two meetings. This is a very kind of well-trodden but familiar process where you need to do site visits. They need to credit analyze the whole track record. They need to meet the team. They take references. Usually they have third-party consultants do substantial diligence reports. And so the sales cycle for this is significant. And whilst that is obviously a fact of life in terms of speed of fundraise, what it does allow you to do is it gives you really good visibility of the fundraising pipeline, because you know that an investor who's already done the site visits, already gone out of pocket by hiring a lawyer and doing that part of the work stream, done the ESG work, done the third-party consultant work, taken the references. I mean, people who are – I mean, we've now matriculated more than 50 investors between the two funds. You know, people who have gone through the process, it gives you quite a line of sight to when they're going to close and – their amounts. And so, obviously there'll be a bit of this where you just have to see the outturns quarter to quarter, but I guess we're being very clear in our guidance that we see strong momentum, and obviously we've got, you know, the underpin for that investor by investor as to who we expect to close when, and obviously the guidance in what we've issued gives you our view as to what's going to close when. So we'd expect to have material closings in the balance of this year. We would then expect to have the fund close at either 2.5, which is the target, or higher, you know, early in 2023, which is as clear as we can get as to what we see in terms of the fundraising pipeline getting through their steps.
Understood. That's helpful. And then in terms of the ERC, the UK unsecured backbook sales, so How should we think about the mechanics of that as you continue to collect until the transaction closes, and then how the proceeds will be received once the transaction closes? You kind of, in terms of the accounting treatment, you've identified that you're going to derecognize 100%, and it sounded like it's kind of a 50-50 profit share on the collections. But how should we think about between now and when you get the regulatory approvals and the transaction closes, how will you recognize the collections on that portfolio? And then is there going to be, you know, presumably no proceeds paid to the buyer until the transaction closes? Will there be some kind of a true-up relative to collections upon the date that the transaction closes?
Yeah, let me say that. So you're right. From an accounting perspective, we've moved 100% of the portfolios into assets held for sale. So we'll continue to record collections on those portfolios up until completion. At completion, we will effectively dispose of those assets which have been recorded as held for sale, and we will recognise a new asset being our 50% share, and going forward we'll book the revenue on that in effect that new asset, which you're right, it's 50% profit share. You should think of that as just a 50% a new ERC at 50% of the existing portfolios. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess fundamentally there's going to be the $150 million of proceeds received upon sale, but presumably there's going to be collections in the interim which are going to be payable over to the purchaser, so there's going to be a netting of those amounts, presumably.
Yeah, that's right. So on completion, the actual proceeds will be the 150 less the collections that we've received in the intervening period from the lockbox date.
Yeah, understood. And just going back to the use of proceeds, you've obviously been very clear in terms of the strategic priorities, but also that, you know, a decision will be made when the transaction closes at that date. But how do you think about potential use of proceeds? Like, is bond buybacks one of the options that you would consider, given, you know, where your bonds are yielding at the moment, double-digit yields, or would you consider leaving additional cash on the balance sheet as a buffer, or do you see, you know, clearly the co-invest is kind of laid out at 10% of total investments as co-invest, but you know, it seems like you've accelerated the expectation around the cash generation. So is there potential for you to go into the market and buy back bonds? Is that one of the options that you would consider?
So if I just give a strategic answer to that, and then you can chat through the more specific tactical brief there. I think the strategic side of that is that the way we think about the business, if we can co-invest in a fund where we put up 10% of the money and we get management fees, carry and servicing fees on 90% of the money, and thereby on our 10% get the investment return plus all that fee income on top, that's a very attractive return on equity, as we've told you. We think it's 40% plus, and we'll show that, you know, in each step as we deliver it. And obviously the thing that just has to pass there is time, right? I mean, just the passage of time is that the NAV of ACL1's established, that's going to crystallize the management fees there. Obviously all the collections against ACL1 have considerable servicing fees. and we started the distribution process of ACL1, that's going to get carry in the door. And so you'll see that 40% ROE coming through as those add up, and we'll show it. So to the extent we can do 40% ROE business, that's attractive to us. I mean, and that's how we look at it. I think Phil and I look at this business, and TDR is very supportive of this, that this, as Phil mentioned earlier, this is a business that shouldn't be 4x levered. I mean, it should be 3, and when you're delivering 40% ROEs, and moving to a capital light model, we want to see that leverage get down. We don't want to effectively collect out the back book and have a residue of leverage at anything like this level. And so our focus is getting that leverage down. Now, obviously, buying back bonds at their current price helps achieve that. So, of course, that's something that, needs to be looked at. But the goal of the business is deliver the strategic franchise and the fundraise. That involves having very good platforms which can feed the funds. Today was a pruning exercise to make sure that the platforms we do have and the capital we do have tied up in platforms do feed the funds. We had a legacy portfolio that was 4 years old and older that had a high cost to collect. We've released the capital from that. And I think you'd expect to see us take actions over the coming weeks, months, years that will achieve the two key priorities I've just described. One, let's make sure our franchise delivers those 40% ROEs, and let's get it to scale so that those flow through to the P&L statement and the cash flow. And let's let the passage of time bring the NAV, the servicing fees, and the carry into the income stream. And let's not be saddled with a legacy debt level that's incompatible with the back book running down. It's, you know, the fact that we were able to make the progress we've made while keeping ERC, frankly, higher than the year-ago period. Obviously, FX has had something to do with that, but that's good progress. But over time, you know, we would expect, as we guided when we issued the bonds, that the size of the balance sheet would stay the same or shrink, you know, in due course as we move the business more to capital light. So I don't think we want to comment today on the specifics of how we want to reduce debt, but obviously our goal is to achieve those twin objectives, get the strategy right, get the cash flowing through the business at those ROEs. I think we're a huge chunk of the distance with the progress we're going to make on ACO2 to lock that in with investors buying into the 10% co-invest and committing in scale. The rest of it then becomes vertically integrated deployment in our own hands. And obviously by selling down, as you say, we've created the basis to accelerate, but hopefully you get the sense from Phil and I that the way you're thinking is the way we want to run the business. Having said that, the specifics of the tactics of that, I think, are dependent on circumstances. And obviously, given we don't have the proceeds for what could be 6 months, however fast the FCA approves the trade, being drawn on the specifics of how we'd handle that is other than to say our priority is deleveraging. I think we're disinclined to be more specific than that, but Phil, let me pass to you in case you wanted to add color to that.
Nothing much to add. I guess the only thing I will say is that, clearly we want to be efficient with our capital structure. So having cash on the balance sheet is not attractive if there aren't the opportunities to deploy that capital either into, bolt-on acquisitions to expand the franchise, invest in the funds as Zach spoken about, or reducing debt. They are the three options that we will primarily focus upon, and clearly we want to be efficient with our use of capital.
Understood. Thanks very much. I guess two last ones, conscious of the time, but I just say them both, and you can address them hopefully fairly quickly. But in terms of your disclosure that 80% of your bonds are kind of fixed rate either through swaps, can you disclose the notional and the rate, the weighted average rate and weighted average term that you have interest rate swaps in place. And then the last one is if you could just give a couple of comments around bolt-on acquisition opportunities, what would be the areas that you might look to in terms of the opportunity set for bolt-on acquisitions if you're choosing to do that? Thanks.
Yeah, I'll take the first and then I'll hand to Zach for the second. So in terms of the 80% fixed rate, I can't, I'm not exactly sure of the notional, but you'd be able to work that out from the percentages, that percentage compared with the fixed rate, so you'll know how much is due to swaps. Broadly, that goes out, half is about 2 years, half is about 4 years, and they've been done relatively recently, so they're broadly at current market rates.
Understood. Thank you.
And on the bolt-on acquisitions, I guess the reason I said the two things earlier, that the two things we strategically want to achieve is running the franchise in a way where the 40% return on equity plus rules down, is that to achieve those rates, we clearly need the vertical integration, right? We need platforms that source deals at attractive returns for our investors, and we need platforms that then service the deals. Otherwise, we don't get management fee, carry, servicing fee, or have the compelling basis to raise funds. So we do need an attractive platform footprint. But fortunately, between the platforms we've acquired in our current markets, we feel very strongly served. I mean, I think given the cycle is coming towards us, and we've built a very strong footprint across Italy, Portugal, UK, Netherlands, and Ireland. And even you'll note at the end of 2021, we bought Maslow, which or the 49% of Maslow, which put us in a very strong place in a key UK sector that's going to be really interesting in the current cycle. We've been pruning the portfolio thoughtfully to make sure that where platforms contribute to our strategy, we keep them or add, and where platforms don't, we exit. You'll have remembered that we also exited White Star Italy, the original Park Credit platform, because we didn't think it added. We'd never done a deal in our funds in that asset class and didn't think it was worth the option value of trying to take that to maturity. So we have a track record of selling the platforms that don't contribute to the funds and adding selectively where platforms do. I would just say that we're very conscious of our leverage level. We've guided to 3x. I think at that stage in co-investing 10% in funds and actually showing the market the 40% ROEs, at that level, I think everyone can assess the business in a transparent and productive way. And that will give us more clearly financial capacity and flexibility to look at where one might want to add to the footprint. But we're obviously successfully raising ATO2 off the current footprint. That makes us disinclined to prioritize those items until our deleveraging priority is moved forward. So I don't want to say we wouldn't do bolt-ons. I think it is well within strategy to do bolt-ons, and I think we have, with our funds business and the capital optionality that creates, a strategically interesting way to do that accretively. And you guys will obviously look at competitors who are entirely bond financed as having different vulnerabilities to us who are raising billions in the funds market. And so we're commercial people. We'll keep an eye on how that evolves. But I think we also recognize that our starting point is not close to where we need to be. We need to keep getting in shape to do it. Part of that just happens naturally with the passage of time as NAV builds, the fees build, the servicing fees build, as distributions to LPs continue, the carry arrives. And it's just part of the deleveraging is just an unwind, but part of it is making good management choices about use of capital, and we don't you know, our priority is deleveraging. We just want to continue to make that clear, and obviously you'll judge us on our actions of living that mantra.
Understood. Thanks very much for all the color, guys.
Our pleasure.
As a reminder to ask a question, please signal by pressing star one. The next question comes from Bruno Redcutting from PGIM. Please go ahead.
Yeah, hi, guys. Thanks for the call. I guess just to focus on the fund management side of things, just to get a bit of color, you kind of spoke about that distribution. How should we think about, and you said it was quite large as well, can you just give us some guidance on how we should think about the cash coming in? Because obviously you've got quite a large co-invest piece there. So just curious, how we should think about that cash coming in, and I guess any sort of guidance on distributions going forward, and how we should think about return on your co-invest piece there. And then I guess obviously, you know, congrats on how ACO 2 is going. You know, good to say you might actually beat the target you set. And I know these things take a lot of time, but just in context of how you're going to, I guess, then move on to ACO 3 and how we should think about the timing on that fund and you guys kind of scaling up beyond ACO 2. And then my last question is referring to how you're actually deploying the capital. What kind of ability do you have to scale up deployments as you kind of have more funds which are larger in scale? Does that mean you kind of need to conduct M&A to have the capacity, or are you just going to reduce the amount that you currently co-invest with PE funds, kind of that third party that you do, just to understand, yeah, how much you can scale up actually, just given how large the platform is going to become over the next couple of years?
Yeah. So maybe if I take your last two questions together and say those are exactly the right questions. So let's just start with the strategic forward role of how you optimize this business is very much dictated by the execution of the answers to your question two and three. I would prefer, and I think it's the right way to do it in a comprehensive and clear way, to basically come to the market, you know, middle of next year with quite forward-looking answers to that, in the sense that the if you think about the unwind and the way the business functions and just getting this right on the ground, this year we need to close this Poplar transaction, do the separation works, et cetera. We need to close ACO2. I think that's the right strategic focus to get the strong foundation to then handle your more strategically forward-looking questions. We're very alive to that, and so the perimeter of answers are things like, do you intend to only have one product, ACO 1, 2, 3, 4, or do you intend to have more? Can you do it off the existing 5 countries and the existing, you know, now 16 platforms, or do you need to add more? Then how would you group it? What would be the allocation policy between funds, as well as which platforms feed which funds? We are very thoughtful on that set of issues, and would say obviously those funds with 10% co-invests are likely to be 40% plus ROE businesses, because if you run them all in the Arrow model of management fee, carry, servicing fee, et cetera, that is our strategy, and that's also our point of differentiation. We have these local platforms, which most fund managers don't, and investors appreciate that we are closest to the asset. And I think in Europe, where you've got 44 countries and all the markets are local and fragmented, having the servicer who's closest to the asset is a highly clear betterment. And I think when you look at the progress we're making in fundraising versus others in the sector, you'll see that. You'll see that investors have embraced that is the better risk-adjusted return. You know, if you're buying a loan in Pescara, Italy, you want to have somebody in Pescara, Italy, not an ex-banker sitting in London. And so I think it's very clear why we outperform, and our future strategies will build on that point of differentiation as opposed to regress to some Me Too CLO thing or some other thing that just has nothing to do with Arrow's point of competitive differentiation of having the platforms. I do think our in situ platform position can support, which you already see, our credit strategies, which are performing well both on returns and scale, our lending activity, which obviously Maslow is a direct lender, not a credit buyer. You have Norfin, which is a real estate developer. So, I mean, I guess I'm foreshadowing that we do have credit opportunities, we do have direct lending, we do have real estate capabilities, and I think we'd like to have, you know, given we service $70 billion of assets, being able to do, for example, the green CapEx projects that the market is so desperate to see. I mean, there's such a momentum of capital around decarbonization and some of the climate transitional projects. Given we service $70 billion of assets, it seems logical to us that there's a win-win for us to use our incumbent servicing platform to facilitate some of those projects, but that's not a space. We have case studies of that internally, but that's obviously not something we have industrial capability in yet. So that's kind of broadly how we're thinking about it. You'll note that that's building off our current platform footprint and not needing a substantially different platform footprint. So hopefully that gives you assurance that we think we can scale our AUM off our current footprint, but exactly the product schedule and the fundraising team, obviously, you know, we're bringing that in-house. We've been investing in that alongside exactly the rollout of when is ACO3 and how do these other strategies interrelate. I'd rather come to the market next year and articulate a very clear version of that in the right time, in the right fullness. I think for now, we need to focus down on just getting the sale we announced today closed and getting ACO2 closed, getting the strong foundation, and then coming back to you with a fully considered plan. But hopefully that gives you a decent level of insight as to how we're thinking about it. Phil, do you want to take question one?
Yeah. And just to add to your answer there, Zach, you know, clearly we have scaled origination significantly. You know, when you go back to 2019, sort of, you know, on the Arrow balance sheet, we invested $300 million. Obviously, 2020 was impacted by COVID, but last year we did $800 million. And today we've announced that we've, you know, we're 11% up on origination. So we have made investments into many areas like real estate that we've spoken about. So, you know, I think it's exactly right what Zach said, you know, in terms of the development. But, you know, there is a lot of scaling that's already in progress. And just in terms of the first question, so Arrow invests through the ACO, through an SMA, and that SMA receives collections on a monthly, quarterly basis, and that SMA is consolidated as an Arrow subsidiary, and therefore you shouldn't think of distributions coming back to Arrow. We record collections from the underlying, from the portfolios which are held in typically in SPVs. Those collections get recorded within our collections figures because the Arrow SMA is a subsidiary.
And on the side, I think you asked the size of the collection. I mean, we or the distribution. I mean, we. Well, and now it's not alongside Q4, I'll just say. It was the largest single collection in Arrow history. So it was a good result, but let us announce Q4s together.
Okay. No, thank you. That color was helpful. And, yeah, particularly on the first answer, Zach, I think completely understand the strategy. And I think having that update next year would definitely be very useful. So, yeah, we definitely endorse that. But thanks for the color. I just have just a couple of smaller questions. I guess, obviously, you have spoken about deleveraging being the target from here. And obviously, we understand as bond investors the broader strategy, but obviously the markets can kind of take a look at some of the more smaller points. Can you just confirm there won't be any, I mean, obviously, because there's such a lumpy collections to come and just the way the business moves forward, will there be releveraging quarter on quarter, or is the plan for every single quarter from now on to be deleveraging, which I know in the context of the way the business is moving isn't important, but obviously just the way the bonds can trade in terms of what they see, sort of headline numbers, it is kind of important to understand that. And then I guess just my last question, just more on the macro environment, just sort of any comments you can make around payment rates, sort of Q3, Q4, as obviously the consumer weakens with inflation and all the rest of it coming through. So any color on what you're seeing there or what you expect to see would also just be useful to understand.
I'll do the second question, Phil, if you do the first. I think on the second, I guess if I roll back to the summer, what I'd say is that there was a two-way tension between the legacy cash overhang, which was considerable post-COVID, and the very strong employment market, which are both reasons to be optimistic that payment rates will overperform. And then on the negative, you obviously have every version of negative macro, right? I mean, from interest rates to cost of living to recession to a weakening employment picture to whatever else evolves, energy costs, et cetera. Up till now, the positive has outweighed the negatives. I think as you'd expect us to, we live in close scrutiny of that dynamic. You add in asset prices, which will become a new issue, i.e., you know, for the last couple of years, clearly house prices have increased. You know, you'll see in the OBR forecast and so on. We run our stress tests, and I think we feel very good about where we are in terms of our entry points, i.e., the cents in the euro or the pence in the pound, in which our entry point is, has a huge buffer for any sort of small, moderate, or even, you know, significant house price movement. That's the beauty of buying the secured at a discount. So, we're scrutinizing that carefully. We're still in a spot where the forces of positive outweigh the forces of negative. You'll see in our performance against ERC. I'd say that is becoming a more finely balanced battle, i.e. that, you know, we were surprised how much the positive outweighed the negative in Q3. At some point, you know, life can't defy gravity. If interest rates go up, costs go up, and incomes don't, I mean, and the cash overhang burns off, customers' capacity to pay has to be affected. Asset prices have to be affected. That's just reality. Certainly the way we underwrite assumes a very harsh version of that. Our sense is so far so good. It's been good news up to literally today in the current collection numbers we see, but we remain, you know, cynical, I'd say, that that's sustainable over the long term. I mean, at some point the gravity of that has to apply if you know, the negative macro arrives in the way that most people fear. But so far, we feel really good about it. And I think the discounts we have against a predominantly secured asset base after today, you know, puts us in a very robust place. But Phil, do you want to talk about the volatility in quarterlies?
Yeah. I guess, you know, you've heard, loud and clear, you know, our commitment to deleveraging, and we continue to expect to delever, you know, through this year. I think one of the things that we have seen and is a function of our book is that you do get slightly lumpier collections with secured portfolios. And as Zach's just mentioned, you know, we had our largest collection, in Q4 this year. That obviously, when that drops out of the leverage calculation, so in Q4 next year, then clearly, you know, that can give you a little bit of volatility. So, do I do I think there's possibilities that we could have a quarterly on quarterly rise in leverage? You know, we did see that from Q1 to Q2 this year. I wouldn't rule it out. What I would say though is that, you know, I expect leverage from the current level to continue to decline.
Okay, no, that's helpful, and that's kind of in line with what we were thinking. And yeah, appreciate the colour on the macro. That's all my questions, guys. Thank you. Thank you for the call and for all the colour.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, our pleasure.
Thank you. I think that's all questions we had today. With this, I'd like to hand the call back over to our host for any additional or closing remarks.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Sergey. Hopefully that's been a very useful discussion. We appreciate the thoughtful questions and the engaged dynamic. And yeah, we feel good about where we're heading in the fourth quarter. Look forward to revisiting these themes with updated numbers when we talk to you guys early in 2023. So thank you.
Thank you. This concludes today's conference call. Thank you for your participation. Ladies and gentlemen, you may now disconnect.